The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to speak to Absa Corporate and Investment Banking about all your import and export finance needs. Absa is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show on a rare positive day for the JSE. Market was up in positive territory. It was nice to see gains coming through on the JSE, predominantly in the resources sector. Resources bouncing really, really nicely on the day. We also saw trading updates today from the likes of Old Mutual and Nedbank. They give us a much clearer idea of what's going on in the real economy. There was this flat panic 12 months ago. Remember it well. Oil prices were down in the doldrums. There really was no hope for the future, and the market was preparing for higher levels of default, higher levels of capitulation at the corporate sector level. And yes, we've had some failures, and yes, it's been desperately uncomfortable for so many people, but not nearly as bad as had been expected. And so as a result, we're seeing this sort of recalibration in the entire economy. We'll also talk to Colin Cullis later on, Business Unusual. If you were offered a four-day week, would you take it? Somebody said to you, well, you know, you can do 5 8-hour days, or you can do 4 10-hour days, or maybe 4 8-hour days rather than 5. Would you take it? Would you want to do the 4-day week thing? It sounds terribly romantic. I wonder just how big an adjustment it would be. And certainly in a country with as little productivity as South Africa has got, I wonder how effective it would be in getting us to work smarter in terms of the way in which we operate as an economy. Also tonight, we'll talk to consumer ninja Wendy Nola. And then insurance aggregation. It's not something I've ever got because I'm just hugely concerned about the T's and C's element. But I want to talk to the chief executive tonight of Hippo.co.za. They were the first to market in South Africa, as memory serves, of an insurance aggregator. And we saw that aggregation come through. And basically, you put in some basic details into a computer program and it spits out this insurer will charge you this much, that insurer will charge you that much. Hippo, when it first came out, was severely criticized because it only had its parent company products on the service. They've expanded it since then, of course. And so we are looking, yeah, be very interesting to see how Hippo has evolved and changed. And of course, it is related to one of the biggest UK insurance aggregators as well. And they've used, it comes from Auto and General Stable. And these guys have taken the UK by storm too. When it comes to cryptocurrencies, which for the first time fell very, very sharply, we saw cryptocurrencies come under a huge amount of pressure. Those cryptocurrencies fell below, well, Bitcoin fell below $30,000 yesterday. Cryptocurrencies getting smashed. China regulation pushing prices to their lowest point this year. There has been a bounce in the market over the last 24 hours or so, but there's still a lot of short-term worry about the future. But as economist Chris Becker points out, he says, oof, what a rough year since June 2020 for Bitcoin and Ethereum. Only 260% and 840% up, respectively. And that, I think, gives you the perspective, doesn't it? The perspective that you need. It all depends on your starting point. If you got sucked in above $60,000 per Bitcoin, you're feeling incredibly poor right now. If you bought 12 months ago, you might not be feeling as clever and as rich as you did 6 weeks ago. But you're certainly better off than you were a year ago.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Consumer prices in South Africa hitting a 30-month high. Official inflation rate spiking to 5.2%. Ordinarily, my mouth would dry up and I get a really queasy feeling in my gut. But I'm not panicky. I'm not really that concerned right now. George Genos is the head of research at ETM Analytics. Should I be concerned? Am I wrong to be complacent about this inflation spike, George Genos?
No, Bruce, I wouldn't be concerned. I think we've got it as transitory. We have an inflation risk model that gives us perspective going out 6 to 9 months, and it's still telling us that inflation's likely to be benign, mostly because the credit cycle that we're in at the moment is particularly weak. And so there's not all that much room for inflation to take hold in a sustained manner for a prolonged period of time. So We're seeing this as temporary. The Reserve Bank, I think, is viewing it very much the same way. They're not likely to be panicking and responding very aggressively in the short term to this kind of news. I think they were anticipating it, as was most of the market. And so we look through the spike towards a more settled inflation environment later this year, beginning of next. And that's going to be a lot more benign than what we're experiencing now.
2 months ago, the US Fed was talking about American inflation being transitory. Suddenly, they've changed their tune. Suddenly, the transitory bus has stopped and everybody's getting off. And they're beginning to get a little bit worried about the rise of inflation and thinking it might be more permanent there. Why would it not? I mean, yes, you've explained the credit cycle here, but we've got real inflationary pressures. Electricity prices going up by 15%. Fuel prices rocketing relative to this time last year. Food prices coming through. I mean, those are the three biggest household costs any of us have.
You're absolutely right, and we would classify those as non-discretionary type items. So you've got to pay those prices, and therefore you will experience that inflation. What typically happens in a very weak credit cycle, in other words, where money supply is extremely soft as it is at the moment, we're talking about very low single digits, and in certain private sector credit extension metrics, it's even negative. In those types of environments, you tend to get a lot of substitution effects that creep through. And the spike in the non-discretionary items can sometimes be more recessionary than it is necessarily inflationary. Over time, these effects will get squeezed back out again, because the money supply environment is as weak as it is at the moment. So the credit cycle is just not there to give inflation the room to become more permanently placed.
Why I think you feel so confident is this thing called core inflation. Core inflation is still low. I mean, if you look at CPI, 5.2%, core inflation sitting at 3.1%. Why is that core inflation number reassuring?
Well, I think it strips out a lot of the volatile prices that have skewed the headline number up. And as a result of that, that's exactly the reason why we have things like core inflation, is so that the Reserve Bank can also utilize it to judge whether there are second round effects that are creeping through, such that it might become a little more permanent than it appears to be. But at 3.1%, as you quite rightly pointed out, I mean, that's scraping the lower end of the 3-6% target. And quite clearly, there are no strong second round effects of inflation coming through there at all. So for the time being, we need to look through the spike and focus on that core inflation perhaps a little bit more, because what you don't want to do is overreact to a spike which lands up being temporary, and in the process land up squeezing even the growth environment even more than it's already being squeezed by things like structural factors and all the difficulties around COVID, Eskom and the likes.
What about global inflation? What about American inflation? That's the thing that's got the market completely flummoxed over the last 2 weeks. The US Fed has begun talking up the prospect of inflation sort of being a bit more sticky than feared. And it really has led to a huge dislocation, massive sell-off in resources. Suddenly somebody flicked a switch and the world went into panic mode.
I think on that front, people and the markets investors had gotten a little bit complacent. We had gotten so used to the Fed just being around with all this ultra loose monetary policy, printing $120 billion per month, keeping interest rates very close to zero. So the markets get used to all of that, and they almost become dependent on that reality. So whenever something comes along that might threaten that, you get this big dislocation, and that's what we've seen. But it settled down pretty quickly. I mean, it lasted 2 or 3 days, and it seems to have settled down pretty quickly. And we even had a little bit of a retrace. Commodity prices have nudged a little bit back up. Emerging market currencies have recovered some of their losses, the rand included. So generally speaking, it wasn't a full-blown rout. It was a check that was, I think, necessary. And so people are going to be a little more circumspect about the data that comes out and perhaps less complacent. than they were. At this point in time, we are a little bit concerned about U.S. inflation, but some of that is very much driven by the fact that the dollar's weakened as much as it has through the course of the past year. That's also going to be cyclical. That'll turn at some point in time, especially if they go down the route of tapering and maybe even choosing to lift rates. But that's still like back end of 2022 going into 2023. So it's still a way off. Dollar could still come under a bit more pressure. U.S. inflation could spike a little bit more and remain elevated for a few months, but we think it comes back down once all these dislocations within supply chains and whatnot get sorted out and life returns to some sense of normalcy if indeed these vaccines work and they roll out to the extent that we'd like them rolled out.
George Glenos, thank you. The head of research at ETM Analytics this evening coming through for us. Thank you very much, George. Yeah, those consumer prices, you're going to see scary numbers. That 5.2% number is scary because it's above the midpoint of the inflation range. And if you watch this 3 to 6% inflation range and you know that 4.5 is halfway between and suddenly we get to 5.2, next step is higher. Well, no, just calm down. Thank you, George Glenos, for soothing our brows this evening. In a moment, we'll have a good close look at markets today. Chris Stewart standing by.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
A little bit of green, Chris Stewart. A little bit of green, a bit of positivity. I nearly fell off my chair as I watched that this afternoon.
Yeah, well, it can't go down every day, I guess, Bruce. And we did see the monetary authorities in the US overnight trying to, I guess, throw oil on troubled waters, saying that don't worry, no rate hikes coming for quite a long time. Any tapering that will be done very gradually. And that, you know, global markets have taken cheer from that. You've seen a little bit of dollar weakness. You've seen a recovery in commodity prices. And that's got our market going a little bit better today as well, Bruce. Yeah.
Yeah, it was only a good day today. And we also had two really interesting trading updates. One came from Old Mutual, which came out first thing this morning, and the second one from Nedbank. Perhaps Old Mutual, with the backdrop of COVID-19 and, of course, the third wave and no ideas to which direction this is going to go and just how bad it can get. I suppose the big worry there is not what's in the update. It's what could come in terms of higher claims from people who claim their sort of disability payments if they get really sick, or their sick leave payments, or they die and life insurance claims spike up, as we have seen come through in all of the life insurance companies over the last 12 months.
Yeah, yes, as you indicate, both Old Mutual and Nedbank coming to market with news today, and I guess at the risk of a very poor joke, one could say that is a very green day indeed. But we have seen Old Mutual mixed update, I guess, somewhat disappointing on the earnings front, particularly relative to what was a quite a robust first quarter that they announced. This is now the five-month period to the end of May that they were talking about. Sales growth, new business volumes that they're writing a little bit better probably than anticipated, particularly in the personal finance space or their middle market area. I think their entry-level mass foundation offering still suffering partly from negative demographics in that part of the market, you know, income being hit quite hard and unemployment, particularly as a result of COVID in that market. And also the fact that I think you've got a very fierce competitor out there cleaning up in that space in the form of Capitec in conjunction with Sanlam and their joint venture. So that area of the business struggling a little bit. Volumes looked okay. The COVID reserves will be reassessed at the half-year stage, they say. So a little bit too early to tell whether additional provisions will be required. And I think if you look across the financial services sector, whether we're talking business interruption insurance amongst the short-term insurers, whether we're talking credit life claims or indeed life claims amongst the life insurers, or whether we're talking about the potential for additional provisions amongst the banks, everyone's saying, well, so far so good, but it's a little bit too early for us to start popping the corks. Nedbank particularly today guiding that, in fact, the impairment charge for the first half, or certainly for the first 5 months that they've seen, will be below the guidance range that they had given at the end of last year, below the better end of their guidance range, but we're also, you know, at pains to indicate that if things get materially worse from a lockdown perspective, as a result of the third wave that we're seeing, you know, in Gauteng and probably spreading across the country fairly soon, then, you know, they're just reserving the right to say that, you know, provisions may tick up again. But thus far, everything looking okay, but still an element of caution out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, caution is sensible. But yeah, it's just, it's, you know, you look at this time last year, hellfire and brimstone, double-digit declines in the economy, better take massive provisions, and the banks were being leaned on by their investors saying, you're not being aggressive enough. Then I think probably accusing the banks of being a little bit too panicky 6 months ago, and now the banks sort of know their business. And now Brait is interesting, isn't it? I mean, it got too clever by half. It really did. Lots of offshore investing, lots of dud investments being made. Are things improving there? They've got a new management team in place and they're really trying to clean it all up. It does seem as if it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a strong market reaction today, but when you're trading at 2.70 rand and you disclose a net asset value that's closer to 10 rand than it is to 2.70 rand anyway, you know, you only need a modicum of reasonable news in order to get the share going a little bit. And I guess that reasonable news was in the form of the fact that the balance sheet's looking a little bit better. They've got two main investments within Brait nowadays. One is Virgin Active. The other is Premier Foods. One is in a very horrible place right now, and one is in a reasonably good place right now. So, you know, the Virgin Active formula, very, very difficult environment in which to be running a gym where everyone gets indoors, gets up close and sweats, you know, close to each other. It's not a great environment within global lockdowns and COVID and that kind of thing. So the gym format has been really, really struggling over the last couple of years, something of an improved performance over the last few months, and you know, have done some reasonable things in terms of shoring up their balance sheet, which is quite important. The Premier Foods, the milling and baking side of that business, bread, wheat, maize, all of those recording strong double-digit growth in revenues. Reasonable year in the grocery space. They've made a couple of acquisitions over the period, particularly in the confectionery market. And as a result of that, that business going quite a lot better. Overall liquidity and cash within the Brait Group, certainly better than it was. And as a result of that, having quite a decent run today, albeit still trading at a very large discount to their disclosed net assets value, Bruce.
I mean, for all of the worries about the end of the bull market in South Africa and the worries about what's going to happen to in the future, the one thing which is providing a little bit of comfort, at least, is that there is no real pressure on the Reserve Bank to start raising interest rates to try and stem inflation. Yes, the cost of everything is going up all the time, but in real terms, the official inflation rate that the Reserve Bank looks at when it makes its decision, it's had a blip, as George Glynis was explaining to us earlier, but we're not heading into train smash territory in terms of inflation in South Africa, at least not just yet.
No, and I guess if Jerome Powell's to be believed, we're not getting into train smash territory with regard to inflation anywhere. There's base effects and COVID-related supply chain constraints globally that they believe is pushing inflation domestically. I'm sure George put this much more eloquently than I did, but you've got very large base effects coming in terms of the fuel price that will wind its way out, assuming that oil doesn't go too far above the $75 a barrel level it's at right now. That should start to normalize in the second half of the year. The inflation data in the COVID period last year was somewhat speculative in that a number of price moves had to be imputed. That should work its way out of the system as well. And, you know, I think there's a generally held view that inflation should get down to somewhere around the 4.5% mark within the midpoint of the range and stay there for the balance of this year, given that demand still pretty muted domestically and inflation is behaving okay. I think policymakers will be loath to move too quickly in hiking rates. So we're probably in for a continuation of the flat rate environment for the balance of this year and then modest rate hikes into next year in response, hopefully, to improving demand, which should in fact be a relatively good thing for many parts of the economy and certainly a reasonably good thing for many of the stocks within our local universe.
Thank you, Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa is a registered FSP.
See, Brian Joffe's Long for Life is considering unbundling Sportsman's Warehouse and has asked that division's chief executive to go and find some acquisitions to grow the portfolio as they try to figure out what is going to inject some life into the share price of the company. No final decision yet on the structure of the group. They are looking, though, at changing the way in which Long for Life works. And I think it's been very frustrating for Brian Joffe, who grew Bidvest, of course, from scratch and was hoping in his 70s that Long for Life would take on a life of its own. But just the economic environment into which it's launched and the environment generally has been considerably tougher than anyone had anticipated. On the next Money Show, personal finance expert Warren Ingram, advice on whether you should have an investment portfolio if you already own your own business. Do you invest in yourself or in the shares, or is investing in shares effectively an investment in self? Interesting debate. Pablo Vittini's big advice for small business owners. And of course, side hustles, the wonderful revolution being sparked by Nick Haralambos. That's all coming up next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
I'm just going to go through the Stock Exchange News Service on a daily basis. And in a small handful of companies that exist in South Africa, you are seeing quite a lot of executive churn and a worrying number of reasons being given that, oh, emigration, oh, leaving, oh, retiring, whatever the case might be. But there's a huge amount of churn happening at executive level in South Africa, which is terribly good news for headhunters, people whose job it is to match people with skills for jobs. They're having a field day, but it is telling of a serious loss of confidence by many in the future. I wonder how management and leadership is changing due to COVID-19 and all of the issues up to COVID-19, of course, which are coming out at the Zondo Commission, and the fact that when you flick a switch in your house, you're not guaranteed to get electricity. People are quite moodaluous, which is another word for worried. And Andrew Woodburn is Managing Director at AMROP Woodburn Man. He's on the line to us this evening from Johannesburg. Are you busier than you've ever been before, Andrew?
Evening, Bruce. Wonderful to talk to you and the listeners. Surprisingly, because I was very conservative about 2021, we are. We won't look a gift horse in the mouth. It's been incredibly uplifting for us. And I think that a lot of our clients are quite optimistic at this point in time. You know, I listen to your show. I'm a long, loyal follower of yours. And I listen to the economic forecasts and the markets and so on. And my read on it has really been that many companies, I think, have got to grips now with the pandemic and have two perspectives in mind. We can hold like we are and survive because we've taken dramatic action. Or if things get better, then we need to prepare for that. So believe it or not, Bruce, I mean, it's not every sector, but I got a call from someone in the hospitality industry, which is now betting on an increased flow of inbound tourists Northern Hemisphere summer 2022. And their reflection is, if we don't move now, get the correct talent, make the appropriate adjustments and preparations, we may miss out on that wave. So I'd like to think that there's a cautious sense of optimism. Of course, there's the markets based on the commodity cycle. And of course, anything to do with online and digital is not only, you know, a trend, but now a necessity. So we're seeing top-end general management required. We're seeing really good CFOs that can navigate in a very uncertain world. And then, of course, anything to do with IT systems, digital, is now heavily in demand. And as you rightly pointed out, stressed because the talent pool is shrinking.
Talk to me, Andrew, about that talent pool shrinking. I mean, one man's meat is another man's murder. As the talent pool shrinks, the talent that remains then has more options open to it. But it's not good for the country as a whole because we are losing far too many skills, and it's happening on a daily basis, anecdotally.
Absolutely.
And factually.
And you're dead right, Bruce. I mean, there are a couple of things I believe have contributed to this. 5 years ago, people made a decision to go because of the then government, state capture, and so on, that we're now seeing come out in Zondo. So they took a decision then to leave, but it takes a few years for your permissions to come through, to find the other opportunities and to move. So the tail of what happened during the previous presidency is still wagging, and we're losing people because of that. We're losing people because, unfortunately, they have a view that other countries are safer in terms of how they see the vaccine rollout, for example. You know, right now, I'm hugely concerned because I believe that the workforce, you and I and others, somewhere between 40 and 60, who are the engine room of this economy, are not having access to vaccines. And I just cannot understand why that's not opened for all comers immediately. So these kinds of things weigh heavily on our professionals, on our well-trained, whether it be theater nurses, through to SAP consultants, through to top-end executives. And they are following through with very difficult decisions that they may have taken a few years ago. And that's affecting the talent pool.
I mean, and you, a lot of people listening to this saying, oh, come on, Andrew, it's just a vaccine. I mean, we would, you know, anybody who expected a smooth rollout and would need their head read. But it's not just about the vaccine. It's about state failure. It's about the state's failure to provide electricity over a dozen years. The state's failure on many, many levels. And this, for many people, is just a breaking point for many.
Let me put this to you. Forget the immigration. We lost people like Peter McClary.
Yeah.
And other seasoned executives, Jabu Mabuza, who I've worked with, and other seasoned executives who we still needed another 10 to 20 years of service to our economy from. Black, white, male, female, it's irrelevant. There are a number of senior executives I know in ICU right now. And the point about a vaccine is you may not be prevented from getting ill, but if you read the science, it does look like it trends mortality or the fatalities of the virus down to zero. And that's the key, is that if someone does go to ICU, we've got a good chance of getting them back again. Whereas without a vaccine, we're putting senior execs and leadership in our country at incredibly high risk. And that does concern me a great deal. I mean, just in another reflection, you know, not all of the players in my industry have been successful and are thriving. I think that at the very top end, for the reasons I've shared with you, there's a lot of activity, as you mentioned. But I think at middle and lower levels, we're seeing a reduction because, of course, headcount cuts were taken on board. Operating models were changed against the impact of COVID. So it's a very dynamic environment. The one thing that I do think is a silver lining that because I always try to be optimistic, and it's why I'm in this country, is that, believe it or not, we've seen more requests for great board work, board appraisals, independent non-executive directors, and so on. And my sense for that is that chairman and nominating committees, shareholders and analysts are looking at what is coming out from Zondo. And they're saying, we need to get that right. We don't want this to happen again. And my sense is we're seeing an increased demand for top-end advisory roles, such as an independent non-executive director or chairman. And so certainly I think that now might be considered a green shoot or a seed for maybe a really good 10 or 15 years to come. And if that can be twinned with a continued commodity cycle, continued good agricultural output, then I think there's demand for top thinkers and top doers in South Africa. And Africa hasn't held back either.
Here's a tip for nothing. Colin Coleman's looking for those sorts of jobs, former general manager of Goldman Sachs in South Africa. He was on the radio on Monday. And he says he'll give his time for nothing, if necessary, in order to, you know, really have a proper impact on helping to fix the country. And there's so many guys like him, huge super skills, people like Andre de Reiter taking salary cuts to try and fix the mess that has been left behind by the lost decade. There are people who are ready, willing and able to do the work. We just got to put them in those jobs.
Group, I'm compliant with your thinking. You know, there's somebody famous who I can't recall said, never waste a good crisis.
Yep.
And
Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of Chicago and advisor, chief of staff to Barack Obama.
There we have it. So between us, we're a great brain, Bruce. But the point is, we've got to activate as a country our ability to harness our top-end intellect, talent, and contributors. We've got to keep them safe, and we've got to give them the opportunity now, to use, let's say, an economic revival of sorts to really capitalize and allow the country to thrive going forward, because that's what will make more jobs and so on. I mean, and in addition to which, people like Colin have certainly mastered the art now of leadership in the digital world, because we're all having to do a hybrid model at the moment. And so even leadership has had to modify their methods, change how they do things, engage with people differently. Actually, you know, besides the crisis, my other favorite saying for Africa is, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Yep. And certainly I'm a strong proponent globally of South African executives who come with highly creative and innovative ability, alongside certainly a very strong element of commitment like we see from André de Ruyter and Eskom. More of that, I believe, is a positive trajectory from the country, and we hope to help facilitate that going forward.
Andrew Woodburn, Managing Director of AMROP, Woodburn Man. Feel better? Well, you should.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Well, thanks to the numerous testimonies at the Zondo Commission, we're all too familiar with the concept of money laundering. But have you ever heard of honey laundering? We know bee populations worldwide are under threat, but what you may or may not appreciate is the impact it's having when you go to the shops and buy what's labelled as a natural product, when in fact it may not be. Chris Westhuizen is the founder of Honeybee Heroes, on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. What exactly is honey laundering, Chris?
Evening, Bruce. So honey is the third most adulterated food after milk and olive oil globally. Honey laundering is basically bulk imported honey, which is usually blended with fructose and rice and corn syrups to lower the cost of production and inflate profits.
So basically, it's diluted with other stuff. I mean, and that happens to milk and to olive oil as well on a large scale.
Yes. Yeah, no, indeed it does. You know, it's you're talking about, in particular, the Chinese market producing about 60% of South African imports. And our imported honey has gone from circa 2,000 tonnes in 2011 to about 6,000 tonnes in 2020. And our local beekeeping economy can only provide half of that that supply. And the landed products coming in at a quarter of the price that the local producers can put it on the table for. So it really does put significant pressure on the local market.
Are there any protections for not only the local industry, but for consumers against a product which is labelled as being something it clearly isn't?
Very little. So, I mean, the American market is a forerunner in this particular space. They put certain embargoes on the Chinese market. And as we see, a lot of markets around that Chinese market start springing up with some significant supply. And so we've got very little protection in the local market for local beekeepers. And a lot of it rests in the hands of the consumer. So that consumer taking the responsibility to try and protect the local industry.
Yeah. And how do we then protect ourselves so that we can help protect the industry?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it always comes down to consumers making good choices and asking good questions. So step one, we have to label honey for honey. So when you're actually looking at the bottle itself, reading the back and seeing what's written, quite often you're going to see local raw honey. The word raw is a good one to look out for. All of our local providers have to have a DAF number, which you would see quite clearly listed on those bottles. But what you would see on our traditional, sort of call it Winnie the Pooh honey with a plastic bottle shaped like a bear, you see a thing that says the product of China and also Africa and or potentially Brazil or Romania or Zambia or Poland. Now, this honey is not always adulterated honey, but it is honey to look out for. So the U.S. have done significant studies on it. I believe one in three sort of bottles on the shelves are adulterated in that particular space. So I'd really always encourage producers or consumers to go and find local producers, find people that really are producing good quality raw honey on their doorsteps, because there are so many local producers that are doing just that.
What about retailers? I mean, do they need to be taking greater responsibility for what they put on their shelves and maybe doing those disclosures? Or is that too much to expect of them?
No. I think it's the right way to go. And some of the retailers are putting effort into the space. You're starting to see sort of big volume raw honey distributors being or dispensers being put on shelves in particular retail spaces, which are good. But we must definitely hold them accountable. And, on a shelf, you can still make a choice, or a consumer can still make a choice. And we must take responsibility for that. I think the other places where we need to put some pressure are coffee shops, sort of large volume chains, where those environments we can really encourage those retailers to make better choices in their own purchases.
Are we not seeing the pressure of the cheap imports? Chinese honey or honey from other parts of the world at a quarter of the price that it's being paid for locally, is there not a temptation for local producers to start cutting the honey as well here and putting in golden syrup or whatever else you might add to it?
Yeah, Bruce, that is the case. I can tell you, if you've worked with bees and you see the amount of effort and attention that goes into 1 teaspoon of honey from the bees themselves, and then seeing the cycle that actually goes all the way through to producing sort of local and raw honey, you'd actually see the value in what a jar of honey should cost. Now, the consumers, unfortunately, are in a position where we have a perception that honey must cost what white bread costs in 2001. You know, it's not 60 rand a bottle. It should be closer to 250 rand for the quality of good local raw honey. What is happening is those local bottlers are unfortunately in a position where they are, incentivized to be making those bad choices. But at least we are in the position to make better choices through asking the right questions.
What are you doing to tackle this problem? I mean, awareness, as I suppose, is a big part of it. But, I mean, it's about helping us, I suppose, to make better choices so we don't see this commercial pollination. We don't see the bees sort of being pushed aside because they're inconvenient to the process of putting the product in the bottle on the shelves.
Yeah, we're trying to bring consumers closer to their product, their food. They're closer to their own food sources. We're running an Adopt a Hive initiative on a variety of properties, be them wine farms, cheese farms, our own farm in the Overberg, where people have the opportunity to adopt a hive, put their own name on it, their family member's name on it. We then bring them out for a free bee course. We do a big bee course every month at no cost. I mean, spots go quite quickly to sort of encourage small-scale beekeepers and hobbyist beekeepers. And we really encourage people to come out and learn about honey, learn about the production of honey, learn about the amount of effort that goes into going into a bottle of honey itself. And that sort of combined with the education is where we see a fair bit of value coming through. I can tell you we've met incredible people that have come to visit us and continue to visit us. And it's those people that we encourage to tell the story. We're almost turning them into advocates for good quality raw honey. And we're not saying buy honey just from us. I mean, we're saying buy honey from local providers, local operators. And it really is something that we do encourage through our program.
Chris Worstason, thank you. Founder of Honeybee Heroes, talking about this concept, I hadn't heard it before, of honey laundering, the dilution of honey with all kinds of other rubbish. And price is your first clue. Price is your first clue. If you've got two bottles of honey sitting on the shelf and one is selling at 40 and one is selling at 140, it's well worth looking at the labels to see what's inside.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by APSA Trade Management Online. Now is the time to speak to APSA Corporate and Investment Banking about all your import and export finance needs. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. Have you been tricked to sign up for debt review? Have you ever been pressured to sign up for debt review? Have you fully understood the implications of what is being suggested to you? It's something that's worrying Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, and she's going to be going into it in a lot of detail. She got a call this week from somebody who was calling from something called Baltic Investments. And Baltic Investments was saying to her, yeah, you get a deal on your repayments, we'll cut you some slack, and all of the promises that come. It's the sort of stuff that you need to be very, very wary of, particularly in tough economic times, because there are people out there looking to take advantage of your good nature.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual
with Colin Cullis.
Business Unusual brought to you by Workforce Staffing. Workforce Staffing providing employment solutions that support staff and profits alike. Colin Cullis, the joy of flexible work is absolutely incredible. And I think many, many people who have managed to hold on to their jobs and have been able to figure out ways of working differently have benefited hugely from this idea of flexible work. But many, 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 many others have been pushed to the brink and some over the edge by the renewed pressures of being always on. I suppose that's the real problem.
It is, Bruce. And effectively, we wind up getting then three groups. The people who are getting those opportunities to work more flexibly, those who are being overworked, and then, as South Africans know only too well, those who are not getting the opportunity at all and can't find, anything. I mean, for some, just getting the chance to be able to complain about work would be a step up
from what they've got. In fact, ahead of the show, I asked, those on Twitter, what kind of toll or what kind of a impact is your work having on you? Your options were, is your work getting more flexible? Is your work taking a toll? Or is your work hard to find? And it might not surprise you, but 51% said it's taking a toll. 30% said it's hard to find, and only 18% said it's getting more flexible, even though the getting more flexible should be where we're all going for everybody. And my starting point was, well, how did we get here in the first place? Because the idea of a weekend for me has just always existed. But as somebody with an agricultural background, you'll know that the early to bed, early to rise mantra for the farming community was that, well, there were no holidays. You simply, when the sun was up and the fields needed to be tilled, off you went, and that's what you did. And when the sun set, you couldn't really easily work, so off you went to bed. You didn't get that one time a year, you know, after the harvest, and then you have the mother all feasts or whatever celebration you create in its honor, take a couple of days to recover, and then start all over again. That was how the world worked.
And, if you recall a classic scene in Downton Abbey, I think the very first series, where I've forgotten the character's names, Maggie Smith's character, and of course the aristocracy didn't really have to work a day in their lives. They'd inherited lots of money, and provided they invested it well, one day of the week was pretty much the same as every other, a bit like working in Zoom world, where every day is Blur's day, because it blurs from one day to the next. But the love interest, Lady Mary's love interest, the lawyer, comes onto the scene and he says, oh yes, of course, Dowager Countess, I'll look at that on the weekend. And Maggie Smith looks at everybody around the table. He goes, what's a weekend? Simply because when every day is one and the same, you don't appreciate what a weekend is. Sorry, that was a digression that wasn't particularly on point, but it's one of my favorite scenes from Downton Abbey of all time.
No, actually, it's quite a nice leading, because we've got to give a hat tip to the faithful, because they gave us the Sabbath. So that was our first day off sorted. But it took a good while longer than that, thousands of years, in fact, before it was overworked factory workers in the UK that effectively just became a lot less productive on a Saturday afternoon, sort of getting ready for Sunday, who would nip off and have a few drinks. That business owner said, okay, you can have a Saturday afternoon off. That was the start of the Saturday. And the first time the weekend as a term came to be used was only in 1879. And obviously it was spoken about before then, but the first time it appeared in print, which allows us to be able to go back and say, when did they start talking about the weekend? Well, that's when it was. And it is, in effect then, such a new thing that the French, fastidious for never wanting to use a single word out of the English language, even are willing to accept le weekend at the end of the week, even though the official term is the end of the week. So effectively, we've only had to wait another 142 years before we can have discussions about extending it from 2 days to three, either making a shorter week or a longer weekend. And the crowd who are proposing this four-day week, I think, are very, very clever about why they've gone about it. One of the guys who's sort of one of the early adopters, as it were, has got a fascinating story for how he wound up explaining it to his company, which didn't obviously go down all that well. But his idea was that people at the office were simply being distracted and not doing what they were supposed to do, or taking care of life. They're getting calls because something's up with the children, or the family is affecting them, or there's a delivery to be delivered. And so they're not doing their work. They're taking all these other things. And so when he had this idea to say, I tell you what if I gave people 4 days of the week where you focused on what you're doing, and then that extra day is for you to go and sort out all that stuff that life requires. And that's pretty much what he did as his trial. And he found that it actually did kind of work. And so when you look at that, that's the upside then for the workers. The upside then for businesses is that you get that productivity back. And not only that, if you imagine that you've got somebody that's working a four-day week, they might not be that fast to say, which 4 days are you working? In which case you can have, rather than nobody in the office on a traditional Saturday and Sunday, you can simply spread people out and effectively have people at the office all week. You can go one step further and say, well, not all of you have to come in early or at the same time. Some of you come in a little earlier and leave a little earlier. Some of you come a little later, work a little later, and you mix that up as well. And then when you take into account our sort of remote working, well, you can go one step further. Don't just start early and leave early. You can start at home, work then, miss the traffic, then come into work. And those that did come in and started in the morning, now with less traffic, leave early and finish your workday at home. Still doing all your hours, still doing all the work, still can have an additional day off, and away you go. And so that's like really where I thought it gets very clever. In fact, let me give you a little take on him just describing what some of the upsides could be.
What would happen to the world if we could take 20% of cars off the road? What does that mean for pollution? What does that mean for infrastructure? What does that mean for stress levels if you had more time to rest and reconnect? What does that do to anxiety and depression? Remembering, one in five of our workforce at any time have got a mental health or a stress issue. What if you could invest in yourself? A day off a week, you could spend time re-educating, training. How does that equip you for dealing with the impact of things like AI? Now, change is here. It's all around. And yet, we're glued to this 9-to-5, 5-day week, 19th century construct. It's time to change. The global interest says it's time to change. Really, really, really does matter. So let's do it. Because after all, what's the worst that can happen?
It's kind of ironic for him.
Such an interesting idea. Sorry, what the irony is?
Well, he is the CEO of a company that does estate planning. So when he says, what's the worst that can go wrong? I mean, that's all that they do. They work on what's the worst that could go wrong. So when it comes from a company who invests all their time working out what's the worst that could happen, then you think, okay, I guess they might be onto something. And again, when they can see the impact of what stress does to people and how it limits their lives, them embracing this is kind of a good sign. And to his credit, he's sort of been selling this story around the world. They've now got a foundation. He's got a book. That was from his 2018 TED Talk about it. So he's been taking a while to get people involved. Ireland has just begun a program that'll see them testing it out from January. They've been testing in the US, in Spain, and even Japan. And Japan is the country that sort of goes the other direction with this stuff. And that is amazing. But I was interrupted you as well.
No, here's the thing. I mean, I get very frustrated when I'm trying to get stuff done on the weekend because so many people aren't working on the weekend. So you have to do stuff during the week. You have to find gaps and you have to try and do all of the stuff that ordinarily you may have done when people were working on Saturday mornings. You may have had the time to do it on a Saturday morning. My worry is you do it on a large scale and everybody does a 4-day week. You then end up having to cram everything into the 4-day week because nobody's working on the Friday anyway. And so therefore you're not getting the service. It's like weekend service starting on Friday. I wonder whether or not at some point it doesn't become counterintuitive, or maybe I'm just too old school on this particular front.
You're right to say that it does sound too good to be true, because it kind of is, and there is a big catch. One of them is that not all industries can do this. It's just not possible. But the other one is that the 4-day week isn't necessarily the same 4 days of a week. There's a lot of people that work on sort of 10-day weeks, of which you are off for 4 days. It's that kind of a scenario. So you work out when is most productive for you to have that time, and then you can break it up. And that's probably how, depending on the industry, it'll go. But for businesses, doctors, for example, you might have argued, well, they've been doing this for a while. They've always had that one day of the week where they pop off to have a round of golf. The reality, that's a group of workers, medical people, particularly now during the pandemic, that are certainly well overworked. In fact, they'd love to get back to a 40-hour week, even if it was 5 days. But manufacturing, mining, construction, emergency services, retail, food services, hospitality, government, and agriculture just don't get to be more productive with less time, because they don't have the issue of disruptions and distractions that take away from their productivity. They literally have to be there ready for you to do something. So it's kind of the businesses like finance and logistics and, you know, service-related companies that should be the ones that lead this. In fact, I'm aware of a company here in South Africa, it's a bank, and they've decided to trial the notion that on a certain day of the week, there will be no meetings. That's the day where you get to go and do all the work that you spent the other day sitting in meetings promising you would do. And I think that's a wonderful small step to move us all forward. But it's not, as you say, you know.
Would you take a 20% pay cut, though, for that extra day of the week? Because now, you know, because are you going to do as much work in the 4 days as you were doing in five, in which case, no pay cut? If the company is now going to have to hire additional people, because this is maybe a way of tackling part of our unemployment crisis, you can actually put more people in work because there are fewer people doing the jobs 5 days a week. So therefore, actually, the salary bill needs to be split a little further. I'm wondering if we'd be willing to take a salary cut to get more lifestyle time, and so to allow our employers to be a little bit more sort of free thinking in terms of hiring new people to make up for the time we're not there.
Well, that's one of the elements that potentially could provide more opportunities for people who currently can't get work. But it also brings us to this notion of tanping, or lying flat, which is currently a bit of a trend in China. And just sticking with the terms that might be new to you, the other one, and this is the Japanese again, who are so fastidiously connected with their salarymen and the long work hours that they even have a word for working yourself to death, karoshi. And yeah. and then you know you've got problems when it works its way into the everyday language. But China's issue was that it has been incredibly successful at lifting millions of people out of poverty and having created the planet's largest middle class. But along with that improvement, living standards, etc., has come an increase in costs and the demand, as you say, we've got to keep the production up, we've got to keep the growth going, which means you've got to have people working longer and harder. In fact, the Chinese have got the 996 routine, noted for working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days of the week. And the one that was new to me, 007, which is just as deadly because it implies you work from midnight to midnight for 7 days of the week, which is just crazy. But in April, a young Chinese person noted that for the last 2 years, he hasn't been working full time. He had been working some jobs and just cutting back on his salary and his lifestyle and taking everything in. He was able to take a snooze during the middle of the day. He was able to lie flat. And a lot of Chinese workers offered the patriotic thing of doing this for your country, being told you can study for great careers, you can work hard and start a family now with more than one child, you can become fantastically wealthy. Seeing that all as a bit of a mirage, because a bit like the capitalist notion of becoming a millionaire, you had to be connected to the right people and you had to be at the right place at the right time. Otherwise, all your efforts actually just wind up leading you to kind of burn out. And this is probably where that 50-50 comes from. And so while there is definitely some issues that relate to how hard it is to work to a four-day week, the notion of us sticking to what we're doing now, while the prospects of automation and, you know, movements away from traditional industries that are massive employers, suggests that we can't just, you know, not business as usual, please. Somebody test this out. Somebody find the weak points. Somebody find the bits that do work. And when we do, let's try and apply them.
Colin Cullis, business very unusual this evening. You're going to freak a lot of people out with that, Colin. Support for minds and bodies alike is essential when expecting the most from your team. Workforce Staffing provides that support through a wide range of employment solutions like access to employee assistance programs. Visit workforcestaffing.co.za now, select your industry and let them help you with your greatest asset, your people. Remain agile and productive.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Wendy Nola is our consumer ninja, and this being tricked to sign up for debt review, Wendy, it's an oldie but a goodie. And in tough economic times, we get these guys who phone you up and say, aren't you so stressed and stretched? Let us help you. What's happened? What story was share?
The story is, and I don't know if you've had one of these calls, but I got one on Monday, and I don't get many of these calls because I've opted out, and I wish I probably shouldn't because, you know, this is research for me. And my partner got one this morning. So if they did what you said, that wouldn't be too bad. If they phoned and said, although it's not really the way you should sign up for debt review over the phone when they phone you, but be that as it may, if they phoned and said, are you over indebted? Are you stretched? Are you just about to or already unable to meet all your repayments every month? And if you said yes, then take it from there and talk about what debt review is, which is it's a specific legal process designed through the National Credit Act to help over indebted consumers rehabilitate. They consolidate your debt, basically. You make a lump sum, gets paid off. You can't get any new credit during that time, and only when you've paid it all off, you know, you are rehabilitated and you can now carry on your life as always. What they're doing, Bruce, is they're phoning up and saying, we'd like to, would you like to pay half your installments? And I actually got that call on Monday and I thought, oh, wow, I've written about this. I've written about people being duped into signing up and then realizing too late when their credit facilities have been frozen or unavailable. And then to get out, you've got to, lose the first month's payment, sort of 5, 6, 7, up to 8,000 Rand, right? So quite a story, this. Anyway, so I thought, oh, yippee, when I got this call. And I said, oh, fabulous. How do you do that? It was a company called Baltic Investments. She said, our program does it. So I said, oh, and why would my credit providers agree to that? And she was sort of, how does it look? Our program does it. And eventually, I was obviously, being a bit too pushy. And she said, I'm only junior. I'll get my senior advisor to phone you. And that never happened. Anyway, I followed up with the company. No, absolutely. So I followed up with the company. I went onto their website. They don't mention debt counseling. I went onto the NCR. They're not registered as a debt collector, which you have to be to be in this game. And I said, you know, what's going on there? And they said, oh, we're a lead generation company. We generate leads for various products, including debt counselors. We are, that's why we're not registered with the NCR, because we don't provide debt counseling. And basically, the employees aren't debt counselors, and they basically just pass on the lead. And we can't divulge the names of those debt counselors that we're generating leads for, because it would be detrimental to our business, blah, blah. If you do need help, let us know, which clearly I didn't. So the problem with that, Baltic Investments, is that the agent several times repeated in that short call, our program does it, when I asked how my installments would be slashed. Our program does it. So really, what if they are generating leads for other debt counselors, for bona fide ones, the question should be, the opening question when they call you up would be, should be, as I said in the beginning, are you over indebted or battling to pay your debts? Not, would you like to pay 50% less on your installments? So I got hold of the NCR and said, how widespread is this? They said, well, we have 107 complaints currently where consumers have alleged that they've been placed under debt review without their consent, because they thought they were just going to get a nice installment break or a reduction. And I said, well, have any of these companies been investigated and sanctioned? Yes, we do have. And they mentioned, do you remember the case of Asia Lamara? She went by the name of Consumer Finance Services. And at the beginning of this year, she had 200 people, mind you, who were making these calls, but they weren't debt counselors. And the tribunal found that she'd allowed these people, not registered as debt counselors, to pass themselves off as such and do the work of debt counselors. And bringing the whole system into disrepute. And she was brought to a halt, as I say, beginning of the year. I think she got R1 million fine. Not sure she paid it, but that was held up. And I said, what advice for people, given that debt review is not meant for any other purpose, not to slash installments, but to pay off all your creditors, right, when you aren't able to yourself? And they said, there are several scams, such as, I hadn't heard of this, Bruce, have you? Ask Auntie Karen, co.co.za, directs consumers to apply to certain companies in order to qualify for their debts to be written off under debt intervention. The NCR says this is incorrect and misleading. But the point is, I mean, it's so bad. But the point is that this is rife now. If my experience, I mean, I don't get these spam calls, because I got one, and 2 days later, my partner got one, different company saying, not are you over indebted, but would you like to pay less on, would you like a lowered installment? And that is just wickedly misleading. I was involved in a case where someone did just that, and they had to pay R6,200 to get out of it and pay to get their life back because the credit card was frozen. He was self-employed and not having any problems paying his debt. The agent didn't ask him, are you battling to pay your debt? So that's the big issue. Anyway, I got that sorted for him, but I suspect I'm going to get a lot more calls, and this is why I want to talk about it now, because it seems to me, my small experience, it seems to be on the rise, and certainly the response I got on Twitter was people saying, yes, it happened to my friend, she fell for it, or, you know, so be wary of someone phoning you up and saying, would you like to lower your installment?
It is, I mean,
installments.
Is it bordering on criminal? Is it criminal? I mean, it strikes me as being certainly against regulation, and everything that is against
it
regulation,
is. Well,
is that criminal, I wonder? And then could these guys be prosecuted?
Well, I mean, that's why I asked. I'm sure this kind of misrepresentation would fall foul of the National Credit Act and then could be taken up by the NCR and ultimately sent to the tribunal, which, you know, has sanctions, has fines, and has the rulings have the same weight as that of a criminal court. So yes, we just need to see more action happening. I mean, they say they've got 100, NCR's got 107 complaints. And the first advice, of course, is to, you know, be wary of the slash your installment offer. And then before signing up with anyone, go on to the National Credit Regulator's site, look to see if they are registered, do some Googling about the company. And, you know, this is a very, serious major step to go into debt counselling, not to be taken lightly. As I said, it goes via the magistrates, of course, for goodness sake. And if you're not prone to reading every word of the small print of the documents that are shoved at you and you're just thinking you're going to get a lovely installment discount, the next thing you know, you're under debt review. I think it's pretty horrendous, shocking.
Thank you, Wendy Nola. You have been warned, Wendy Nola, on the case, our consumer ninja. Be very, very careful of call centres bearing gifts. Nope.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Shapeshifters brought to you by Camellia Holdings, your trusted service provider of all things ICT. Brandy Duchesne is the chief executive at hippo.co.za. You know the hippo. The hippo is famous. The hippo escaped and ran around Gauteng for a bit, but that was a real one. But Hippo has been at the forefront of insurance aggregation since, I don't know, the early days of the internet. Have you tried an insurance aggregator? You go to a site, you put in your requirements, you wait for it to spit out quotes and eventually help you navigate the complexity of trying to compare quotes, because insurance is quite fraught. If you've ever sort of sat with five different policy documents in front of you and tried to make a choice, the aggregators are designed to make that choice easier for you. Was it the first aggregator, Brady, Hippo, in South Africa?
Yes, Bruce, evening. Definitely in terms of financial services, it was, and it's still today the biggest aggregator in South Africa.
How do you define big in terms of aggregators? You had a hippo as your mascot. Yes, hippos are big. How do you define size when it comes to aggregators?
Well, we have 3 million people visiting our website on an annual basis. And these days, it's not just about car and home insurance comparison. They also come to Hippo to compare things like loans, medical aids, health insurance, funeral insurance, life insurance, and now, more recently, fiber.
What? Okay. I get that you could do something like funeral insurance. You're dead, you're dead. You need money to be paid out. That's fairly simple. It gets a bit more complicated, doesn't it, when it comes to things like medical aid and life insurance, because there are lots of T's and C's attached to those sorts of finance products.
Yeah, they are, but largely these products are regulated and they're becoming more and more commoditized. And really, you know, the consumer can largely make a comparison based on price. And we also do highlight product differences, but they're pretty much commoditized these days. And you know, customers do phone around and try to do that work by themselves. And we you know, at Hippo do the heavy lifting for them. And they just have to go and fill in a form on our website. And a couple of minutes later, they get prices from multiple service providers. So, you know, I think it's a service offering that adds real value to the end consumer.
I mean, if you drill into Hippo and who Hippo is, it's all out of the Auto and General Group, isn't it? I mean, this is Doe Steyn, who was sort of one of the massive innovators of South African insurance in his day.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the group's now known as Telesure Investment Holdings. That's the holding company of quite a few local short-term insurers, as well as a life insurer. And then, of course, Hippo is part of that stable now.
But then Doe also went and did, in the United Kingdom, went to took aggregation to an industrial level there and used a meerkat, Vladimir somebody or other. I mean, it was just the weirdest thing looking at that. And it's caused people in the UK to come to travel to South Africa to see meerkats. I've got friends who live in London and came and stayed, and they went on a road trip and got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to see meerkats, all because of the insurance aggregator in the United Kingdom. It's been the most extraordinary sort of cultural icon. He's Vladimir or something like that, isn't he?
Yeah, that meerkat is actually, it's pretty crazy. He actually is a Russian-speaking meerkat with a whole backstory of how he escaped from Africa to Russia and then went to the UK to set up price comparison site. Hugely popular, hugely successful business. And Hippo was built on the back of the success that we saw coming out of the UK.
Okay, so the UK was first and then Hippo came off the back of it. Is it the same, roughly the same sort of technology, or is it a fundamentally different proposition?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I guess initially what you need to do is make sure that you got a panel of partners who want to participate. That was our early challenge. And over time, what we've done quite successfully is integrate more and more panel members. So across the different verticals that we compare, we have 92 different partners. And in our largest vertical, being car and home insurance, we now compare 15 different offerings from 10 different insurers.
And how many of those are owned by Telesure? Because in the early days, you did get into a bit of trouble because I don't know if you deliberately excluded or nobody else bought into the idea in the early stages, but somebody one day wised up and went, hold on a second, but you're all owned by the same company. That smells fishy or hippo-y or whatever.
Well, Bruce, it was never our intent to only have Telesure partners on initially. But, you know, unfortunately, local insurers were not keen in participating in aggregation. So we had to do what we could to get started. But these days we have King Price on our panel, we have Pineapple, we have iWise, we have Old Mutual Insure, we have Dotshire, and we're about to add one of the bank insurers. So, and that's just in the short-term space. In the life space, we have up to 15 different insurers and only one of them is owned by Telesure. So clearly, you know, our value proposition is only as strong as the strength of our panel. And what's interesting is that there are some big names obviously missing from that list. And the question I would ask as a consumer is that, why are those insurers not wanting their product to be compared? And, you know, there's one particular large direct insurer that won't even give you a price online. They let you fill in a form for a price online, but then they get their consultant to call you back and tell you what the price is. And, you know, I guess their thinking behind that is if they get their agent talking to you, they have a better chance of converting you into a sale before you can go and compare their price with somebody else's. So, yeah, ideally, you know, that's not good for consumers, that certain insurers are still holding out. I think that's the more pertinent question is
What sort of IP do you have to give away when you come onto an aggregation site like yours? Because if I'm an insurer, I've got to allow you to be able to delve into my insurance nether regions and have a good ruffle around to see what my policies are, what my T's and C's are, and what my pricing is.
No, not at all, Bruce. So basically, we work with an API integration, and really all that happens is that the customer fills in a form on our website and we pass the data fields to the insurer. That insurer then runs that through their pricing engine and sends back a price to us. So we're not actually getting into any of the insurer's IP. All we're doing is displaying one field that comes back, and that's really the price, without us having to go anywhere near their systems.
And what sort of responsibility do you then take? Are you simply the facilitator of the transaction? How does that work?
No, we're not. Some insurers actually don't have the ability to convert those policies into those leads into policies. And we've actually more recently set up that sales fulfillment capability for certain insurers. So it all depends on the arrangement and who we're working with. In some cases, we just pass on a lead. In other cases, we actually convert that lead into a policy on their behalf.
It's a massively interesting world. Bradley Duchesne is the chief executive at hippo.co.za. We'll talk more to him about his career, how he got there, and some interesting boards that he sits on. What's the connection? I can't pronounce half of these. We'll talk about that in just a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
One of South Africa's more successful financial services exports has been short-term insurance. Bradley Duchesne is chief executive at Hippo. And this isn't directly in your patch, but I think as part of Telesure. Just give me a geographical lesson in how far Telesure reaches in terms of insurance, Bradley.
Sure, Bruce. So our international group holding company is called Budget Holdings Limited out of Guernsey. We have the business in the UK that we spoke about a little bit earlier called Compare the Market, the biggest aggregator in the UK market. And 50% of all car and home insurance is actually bought through aggregation in the UK, and we probably have 50% of that market. We then have a business in Australia. That business is actually a kind home insurer, so a short-term insurer, and Compare the Market actually operates in Australia. The UK business then expanded into France and set up another meerkat under a different name called Le Ferret, the ferret, doing the similar thing. We have an operation in Singapore that is an insurer, a comparison site in Thailand, and an insurance brokerage in China. And then as well as a comparison site in Turkey that I was responsible for going and establishing some 8 years ago.
It's a hell of a reach. I mean, and you're not listed, and so therefore you're not in the public eye in the same way as other insurers in South Africa are. And I suppose that's allowed you to really be able to expand under the radar, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what was built in South Africa was sort of world leading at the time in the early 80s. That allowed us to get into markets where things had become a little bit staid and we're ready for disruption. And we've done exactly that in those territories. Our Australian business is growing at 25% year on year for the last 5 years.
What was built in South Africa in the early 80s was so good that it allowed that disruption to happen?
Well, we were the first direct insurer in the country and probably one of the first globally. I remember joining the company some 29 years ago, and in those stages, fax machines were pretty new in a business environment. We were already doing paperless insurance, recording the conversations and then issuing policy documents without a client's signature. And that allowed us to build a whole lot of data back then that enable us to price more efficiently and therefore make better margins than anybody else was doing at that time.
So was that the model then that was exported and then sort of built on outside of the country?
Yes, it was. So initially we set up an insurer in the UK, but the market's a little bit different there with long tail risks. So what happens is there's a lot of passenger liability claims, and those claims can take years and years to settle. So it's a little bit different here in South Africa where we have the Road Accident Fund, and so we don't have to be bothered with those kinds of risks. And so we didn't quite understand that market effectively, and that's when the business pivoted to become a broker at first, and then finally to get into price comparison.
It's an astonishing journey, isn't it? And I mean, you've been part of this journey. You're part of the furniture within that Telesure group, because very few people stick in companies for 29 years. That's a life sentence in many countries.
Yeah, it's any place I've ever worked, Bruce, straight out of varsity.
You've obviously done well, and that's great. But as you look at the revolution, and so many people in insurance have sort of broken away and gone and done their own thing, at the risk of upsetting the bosses, have you never been tempted?
Every time I've been tempted, something new's come along, and I've done lots of different things from running operations, running marketing, setting up new ventures, and so. Always, been exciting opportunities that aren't often always around in a smaller enterprise. So, had the opportunity to go set a business up in an overseas territory, which not many people have that opportunity. So, I've been pretty happy where I am.
But in a world of fintech, Telesure and Auto & General before it were early disruptors. I mean, you were shaking the market and freaking the market out. Are you now at risk of being disrupted? Or are you leading in that disruptions field as fintechs? All you need nowadays is an application, it would seem, and you can, change the world. There is a huge amount of sort of startup energy happening, and insurance seems to be sort of at the center of that in financial services.
Yeah, look, Bruce, we because of our international footprint, we have a good sense of what's happening globally, and we stay on top of all of those new trends. I think what some of the fintech startups are struggling with is that, it's easy to build a front end that consumers can engage with, but you still got to have the back end capability of running an insurance company effectively, and that's when many of them fall short. So Yeah, there have been some successes, but largely no major disruptors up until now.
Are you looking at those at this industry with fresh eyes, though? Because I mean, it's so commoditized, as you pointed out earlier. It's so ferocious, and the margins are quite thin. It's quite an exciting space from that perspective. You might call it a nightmare as a consumer of insurance products. It's exciting.
Absolutely, and you know, it's a pretty competitive landscape here in South Africa. I suppose though the margins might be pretty thin for certain insurers, Teleshare's always had a history of being extremely profitable. I guess the biggest challenge at this point in time is top line growth. I think consumers are under pressure, and the market for car and home insurance hasn't necessarily grown significantly over the last decade.
It's the factor of almost zero growth for most of that decade. Bradley Duchesne, thank you. Lovely insights this evening. Chief Executive at hippo.co.za.